Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining us for the Kopernik Global Investors Quarterly Call. On today's call, we have David Ivan, Founder, Chief Investment Officer, and Lead Portfolio Manager, to discuss Kopernik's views on the current market environment and portfolio positioning of its global all-cap strategy. Please note, this call is being recorded, and the topics on this call are for informational purposes only and should not be regarded as a recommendation or an offer to buy or sell any product or service to which this information may relate. Certain products or services may not be available to all entities or persons. Please consider all risks carefully before investing. All participants will initially be in a listen-only mode. Following Mr. Ivan's discussion, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To ask a phone question, please press star 1 on your tone phone. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Kasim Ghaffar, Principal at Kopernik.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for joining this call and for the continued support. Before I pass it over to Dave for the investment and market update and for the bulk of the call, I wanted to do a quick firm update. Overall, on the firm level, as of the close of last quarter, we're currently at $1.49 billion. If you compare this to end of last year, we were roughly at $1.14 billion. So from 1.14, we're up right now close to 1.5. So obviously, things have continued to progress really well. During the first quarter of this year, in addition to on the retail side, so in addition to the mutual fund, we've seen healthy, consistent flows in our institutionally managed separate account business. So we've seen a lot of uptick on the institutional side of the firm. If you look across all channels, what you do see is we have been big beneficiaries of many of our clients looking to invest away from other managers or looking to invest with us alongside many of the other managers who in many cases have had very similar portfolios where they're all positioned in the so-called popular trades such as being bullish on the U.S. after a strong rally. So clearly given our portfolio positioning, we have been a very good diversifier for many of our clients' portfolios. On another matter, just in terms of housekeeping, on our firm website, kopernikglobal.com, we just finished up two pieces called the Kopernik Perspective, and one piece is on gold and one piece is on Russia. I think they're both a very good read, so please have a look on our website or email us if you have any questions about that. Before I pass over to Dave, just one last thing for the call today. Dave will be speaking to and referring to a presentation which was sent to you in the invite, and also that link can also be found on our website. So with that, I'll pass it to Dave for the call. Thank you.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for joining us in these markets. It's always timely to talk about what's going on, and now is no different. We have sent out links to a presentation, so we'll be going through some of the slides. We'll skip over some, but they'll all be available on our website afterwards. But some of them might be helpful. In terms of philosophy, process, people, I think most of you know that, so that'll be available on the website. And let's just skip to page 6. And always like to start with comics. They say it better than I can. But QE has been divisive. There are many that who think that QE has led us to nirvana. There's others that think it's led us to the brink of Armageddon. We think there's a little bit of truth to both those views, and within that is opportunity. If we skip to page 8, as we like to do, start with the challenges. Let's start with the bad news. Bad news that we're all aware of for all of us and for our clients, for people that have accumulated capital and savings and trusts over time, that is certainly bad. The news that the central banks of the world have decided that we shouldn't earn a return on that. It's interesting times when the return on bonds is next to nothing. And even more interesting, as I'm sure you've all read, that there are trillions of dollars in the market that are trading below zero now. So worse than nothing. People are having to pay money for the right to loan money to semi-solvent nations around the world. That, we think, presents a problem, and it's pretty well known that playing with interest rates causes malinvestment. And with that in mind, there's been a lot of asset, some people are calling bubbles. Certainly the bond market looks like a bubble. Other things, sectors within the market, for the first time in 15 years of the waning days of the technology bubble, and we also use comic strips like this, but it is interesting that once again, fundamentals are not required to have high asset prices, and money losing stocks are some of the best performing now. They were certainly some of the best performing in 1999. Yeah, outside of that, there's certainly been big runs in real estate and art and collectibles and a lot of other things. Stocks are a mixed bag. We're finding a lot of bargains out there. However, the U.S. market in particular is right up there with the 29.99/07 sort of valuations that have led to the problems. Yeah, hopefully people can't hear, but here in Tampa, the thunderstorm, Mother Nature's given their opinion, I guess, on valuations. Hopefully that won't bother people too much. At any rate, stock market prices have gotten to be a bit of a concern in the U.S. It's been pretty bifurcated, not only within sectors, but across the world. So this chart on page 10 shows what I think we all know, that last year, if you didn't own the U.S., you probably didn't do well. See, the world as a whole lost money. EFA did really poorly. Emerging markets did really poorly. Pretty much just like 1999, when you either owned tech or you looked like a fool. Last year, you owned the U.S. or you looked like a fool. 99's aftermath created opportunity in other sectors. We believe that will be the case here. Now, the U.S. market is expensive on a lot of majors, but not horrible on PE. It's extended. Here it all comes down to margins. The U.S. market clearly has benefited from record margins. That's a good thing. However, logic and theory would suggest that these margins will not be sustainable in a zero interest rate environment. So another thing for us all to worry about. Is the U.S. market done that well because the economy's booming and earnings are coming through wonderfully? Nah, it's mostly been dollar related. The dollar's had a big move as opposed to stocks in particular. That, I guess, is in a good news. It makes our wealth worth more. However, strong dollar, not that long ago, people thought was something to be feared. Now we have to wonder, one, whether it will hurt the economy, and two, whether it will be sustained. Time will tell. And theory doesn't always hold in practice, so QE was supposed to make the dollar weaker. Everybody was sure QE was going to make the dollar weaker. Everybody hated the dollar 4 years ago. It made it stronger. The strong dollar was supposed to be really bad news for the markets and the economy. Thus far, it has not been bad news. QE was supposed to create asset bubbles. It has done that. But the asset bubbles were in turn supposed to create a wealth effect that was going to create jobs and make people, make the economy better. Thus far, it has failed to do that. So, a lot of challenges, but let's now turn to the better stuff, the opportunities that all this malinvestment has created. So, investors, I think every year, get a shorter attention span. Now everybody's obsessed with every murmur from a Fed official on what money supply might be, or every short-term bit of data from government bureaucrats on what jobs may or may not have done in the last month. And they are pouring in and out of sectors, in and out of ETFs. They're playing the market like a casino as opposed to investing in companies. That, we think, creates opportunity. Our last commentary was entitled The Twilight Zone. Most of you have probably seen it. For those of you that haven't, it's also on our website. But we talked about how fundamentals and stock prices have become divorced. And some of the things with the best fundamentals actually had the worst stock price performance, once again, like 1999, and how some of the more challenging fundamentals were being rewarded. Interesting enough, some of the things that were most out of favor and most divorced from fundamentals are off to a good start this year. We'll see if it lasts, but not long ago, some of the most hated things on earth were Chinese stocks, Russian stocks, and gold miners. And thus far, they're some of the winners this early year. We'll see if that lasts. But at least they're started. What has not started to move with the fundamentals yet are a few other things. And one of our favorites being uranium. We felt good that we liked the fundamentals of uranium. We thought it was more constructive than most other energy sources. And sure enough, when energy prices had a really bad year, uranium prices did not have a bad year. They had a good year. This chart shows that over this period of time, uranium prices went up by 19%. We own this one position, uranium participation, that just holds uranium. A reasonable expectation would have been for that to go up 19%. It went down. Also, one of the major uranium miners would be a leverage play on those increasing prices. You would think that would have gone up by a lot more than 19%. It went down by 23%. So there continues to be a little bit of twilight zone in the markets, and that hopefully bodes well and leads to gains just like it had some of the other sectors we mentioned. The uranium price, it's nice that it's up. Will it last? Fundamentals would suggest so. A lot of years of supply being insufficient, but being made up from other sources. There's been the misconception that Fukushima was the end of nuclear power. We've got a chart here showing that now there might be 50 plants shutting down, but that'll be offset by 142 coming on stream. Demand's going to increase. Supply needs to increase. It can't continue to come from secondary sources. In particular, a program that ended a year and a half ago of turning Russian bombs into fuel. So that continues to be one of the more interesting areas. Similarly, coal has less attractive fundamentals than uranium, that's for sure, but it also has, in its own right, some very good fundamentals. There again, you get the idea that coal has become obsolete. Certainly all of us like to see what's happening with solar power and wind and clean energies, and we're hoping and expecting that continues. But coal has not gone away. It continues to be far and away the biggest source of electricity production. It's gone up almost every year of my lifetime and is now falling off a little bit and will probably continue to fall off a little bit. It is not going away. And if it's not going away, how interesting in this chart to show that, yeah, we mentioned uranium going up, but coal prices, you can see the top two lines have not gone down very much, even as gas went down a lot and oil went down a tremendous amount. The bottom chart shows that when oil and gas were going down a lot, oil and gas stocks didn't go down very much. And when coal held prices held pretty much, coal stocks just got beat up in the market and now trades at below a dollar a ton. Mismatches like that are the things that excite us as active investors. Another form of power, hydroelectric power. It used to be loved because it's cheap, it's clean, it's got a competitive advantage, it's got no greenhouse advantage. And those of you that have been with us for a number of years probably remember when Idaho Power was that big holding for us, and it was trading around book value, which seems too cheap for a monopoly with a huge competitive advantage. At the time, the Brazilian hydroelectric power was trading about half of that. That seems fair. There's reasons to prefer the U.S. to emerging markets. Since then, Idaho Power went from one times book to almost two times book, whereas the Brazilian utility went from half a book to 15% of book value. Company's bigger now. It's got challenges. It's got problems. But 15% of book value and less than 15% of replacement value for cheap, clean utility electricity, that we expect is going to turn out to be interesting for the future. Elsewhere, we have mentioned that that Russia's maybe bouncing back for now. We'll see if that lasts. What really hasn't bounced much is Brazil. So we have had that to the chart that many of you have seen from us in the past. Once again, I got this idea back in the late 90s from a gentleman who was comparing Intel to India, with Intel being worth more than the entire country of India. At the time, that seemed reasonable to most people. Now, in hindsight, how could that have ever been? Apple's a wonderful company. We like them. We wish them well. Three-quarters of $1 trillion is a big market cap. It will take a lot of right decisions for a lot of years to support that, we believe, and hopefully they do. But what we find most interesting is that Brazil and Russia are both top 10 economies in the world, and they're both some of the biggest in landmass, biggest in terms of resources they have, and certainly will be growth economies over the coming decades. They shouldn't sell for less than one particular company, no matter how good it is. It reminds us of Newton watching gravity affect the apple. Will that happen again in a different sense? Time will tell. But certainly Brazil and Russia are not beloved members of the BRICS like they were 4 years ago. They are on sale. As far as the U.S. dollar, it's bounced now, but that's within a huge secular decline. Which one's real, the recent bounce or the long-term trend? We think that all comes down to money printing. Ever since the Federal Reserve was created, and certainly ever since we came off the gold standard in 1971, money's been printed. Purchasing power of the dollar has dropped. It's dropped against most everything. They've temporarily stopped printing, and they're going to do the printing in Japan and Europe and elsewhere. But over time, we would suspect that it's good to own some things outside of the dollar. Gold, we've imagined it's starting to bounce, but it is so depressed and so cheap, it's got a long, long way to go. This is saying, all right, the price of gold's gone up, but let's adjust for that by how much money's been printed. You can see the price of gold relative to the theoretical price of gold, the fully backed dollar price of gold. Gold has never been cheaper. We continue to like that a lot. So, where are we now? There's things that are pretty cheap. There's still a lot of belief all around the world that we should take turns handing off the baton on who can print money. Printing money has effects. It's usually not the effect that's intended. And we think that bodes well for a lot of things in the portfolio, in particular gold, which just like Apple being worth more than whole countries, all these gold companies are less than lots of little companies or pretty big companies, but we think that's a mismatch when something that's served as money for thousands and thousands of years in aggregate can be worth less than some stocks. More importantly, whereas the U.S. market is a bit challenging, it's interesting that the once beloved growth markets of the world, the emerging markets, have grown. They have become a lot bigger than the advanced countries, and yet they're not priced like it. I can see at the chart at the bottom of this page, PEs, price to books, price to cash flows, a lot of things. It's the BRICS look interesting. Korea looks interesting. Hong Kong is having a big move now, but that was off a low base. So the market is allowing us to look selectively at individual businesses that just happen to be too cheap, and if they're in some of these emerging markets, they probably are too cheap. And another way to look at it is what the market cap relative to GDPs are. The U.S. is the biggest country in the world. It deserves to have the biggest market cap of the world. If it were 22% of the all-country world index, I don't think we would be arguing with anybody about whether that was fair. 52% of the all-country world index in any one country, I think people will in the future look back at that and shake their heads. But less important on whether that proves to be okay. You'll notice big countries with big impacts on the world have 0 to 1% of the all-country world representation. India, Russia, Italy, Brazil, these have almost no representation in the all-country world index. They are real countries with real economies, with real resources. And so, once again, we believe that in their rush to pay up for expensive stocks, there's a lot of great businesses around the world that are way too cheap, and the market might be in the process of starting to recognize that. Time will tell, but certainly we feel good about it. And I'd like to spend most of the time on questions and answers, so thank you.
If you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal. We'll take our first question from Richard Cheever with North Berkeley Investment Partners.
Hi, thanks for your time. Just kind of an overarching or a broad question, I guess. How do you go about differentiating between what you view as companies or industries that are cyclically out of favor as opposed to companies or industries that are in some sort of structural decline?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, from the bottom up, we look at businesses and we look at the industries they're in, and we try to figure out supply and demand, and into our models we input whether they seem to be growing or seem to be in decline, and then we try to obviously pay up more for the ones that are growing, and we're going to get a much lower theoretical value for ones that are shrinking. Like everybody, we prefer growth. Unlike others, if we can buy a mature company or a shrinking company at way less than it's worth, we're happy to do that. It is interesting, whereas in the stock market, people seem to want to pay a fortune for growth and pay nothing for no growth. They're willing to pay a fortune for bonds with fixed coupons that clearly are not growth. So that's an aberration. But our analysts look at each industry, and we put a lot of time on what can be sustainable demand, and usually it's right along the GDP and just above population growth. Some industries can sustain more than that for a while, but usually not a lot. And then we look at supply. Is supply unlimited? We're going to have less confidence in the ability of that business to do well if supply can come pouring in. If demand is sustainable and supply is scarce, we're more likely to assume that our models will come through or even do better than we expect. And so we calculate the theoretical value, including whatever growth rate seems appropriate and whatever margin seems appropriate under different scenarios. And then we calculate our margin of safety, and not to go too long into this and bore people, but margin of safety is important. A lot of value-oriented investors insist upon it, but we look for bigger margins of safety for companies where things are more in doubt. A company that's in secular decline might have more margin problems. We might want a bigger margin of safety for companies in secular decline. A management team that we're less sure they know how to allocate capital correctly, we want a bigger margin of safety. A company that's in Russia or China, we want a bigger margin of safety, and so on. So all of this is done bottom-up, calculating evaluation, and then throw in our knowledge of all these things into to try to get bigger margins of safety for companies with more challenging or uncertain outlooks.
All right. Appreciate it. I'll get back. Thank you.
Once again, it's star one if you'd like to ask a question today. Star one. We'll go next to Philip Schlockman with PSQ Capital. Mr. Schlockman, please check your mute button.
Thank you. Got it. So, David, just our observation in your portfolio is that it looks like it will set up really well if and when we ever get a reflationary type environment, you know, something similar even to what has gone on in the market in the last couple of weeks. Do you foresee any catalysts or events that ultimately will swing kind of the global mind share over to that type of market from where we are or have been for the last couple of years, which seems to be more worried about the downside risk to inflation and the excess capacity that's out there?
Mm-hmm. We try to do things bottom up, and we feel that with or without inflation, we really like our portfolio. I will point out that most of our big holdings are companies that are dominant market share companies and businesses that meet the needs of a growing middle class around the world, whether it's electricity or gasoline or protein foods or cell phone services or transportation. These are the companies we own. We think they'll do fine with or without inflation. We also think the biggest predictor of future performance and the biggest predictor of lack of risk or, you know, lower risk is valuation. And on this portfolio of dominant companies and what we think are good markets, the price earnings in our portfolio is about a third less than on the all-country world. The price to cash flow is two-thirds less. The price to book is three-quarters less. Our price to book is less than 0.6. So we think there's a portfolio of companies that should grow, should do fine, and even if they didn't grow, the stock should re-rate forward. However, to your point, where we don't view ourselves as macro, there is absolutely no question that the marketplace in aggregate is macro. There are lots of people who get opinions on something and they pour their money into it. And if people like big stocks, it pours into the big stock ETFs. And if they like the U.S., it pours into the U.S. ETFs. And 4 years ago, people were saying, my God, inflation's going to be a big thing. Let's buy the gold ETFs, and let's buy the infrastructure ETFs, and let's buy the emerging market ETFs, and let's buy the agriculture ETFs. And because so many people were playing that, those stocks became more expensive than they otherwise well it would, and maybe those things needed to come through. They didn't come through at the same rate people expected. Now these stocks, it's sort of the best of all worlds in our opinion, because people have sold all of these themes, because people don't believe inflation's possible, and because they don't like emerging markets anymore, and they don't like agriculture anymore, and they sure don't like gold anymore. These things are priced so cheaply that we believe that we'll probably do really well, even if there's no hint of inflation. And to your point, if the market starts to perceive inflation, then there's tremendous upside to this portfolio because there is a lot of things that are likely to do well. And inflation itself is an interesting concept because most of the world seems to think that we're in this deflation and that inflation's impossible, where we think inflation is a monetary phenomena. We think the money supply in the U.S. has gone from 0.8 trillion to 4.5 trillion, and the money supply is growing quickly in Japan, and it's growing quickly in Europe, and it has grown phenomenally fast in Switzerland, and it's grown in the U.K., and it's grown like crazy in China. And so people that don't see the inflation are looking different places than we are. Now, what have the symptoms of that inflation been? The symptoms have not been in the CPI. The symptoms have been in record high prices for U.S. bonds and record high prices for European bonds and record high prices for U.S. stocks and record high prices for art and record high prices for collectibles and soaring prices for drugs and healthcare and record high prices for education. But the last 3 or 4 years, it has not been going into the price of food, it's not been going into the price of gold and those sort of things. Once again, if it rolls back into those things, that'll be wonderful. If it doesn't, we believe buying companies that fractions of book and single-digit PEs will be fine without inflation.
We'll take our next question from Hayden Cole with Essex Asset Management.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question, David. I was very interested in the comment that you made about the MSCI World Index and the weightings of particular emerging market economies. And I wondered, as you sort of forecast that those are going to increase in value and market cap, how you, if you have a time frame in mind where you think that their weightings will be more accurately reflected on the MSCI World Index?
Yes, thank you, because actually an earlier question, somebody asked me about catalysts, which I neglected to address. Catalysts are not something we've ever spent much time on. We like it when we find them, but usually stocks have moved tremendously before we or anybody else see the catalyst. You know, March 10th of 2000, for some reason, the NASDAQ stopped going up and small value stocks started going up. There was no reason to this day. Nobody's told me a reason. And, you know, why is it in 07 one day all of a sudden banks finally started falling when the problem loans had been apparent for quite a long time? And I believe very, very strongly that when you can buy great businesses and good economies at really, really cheap prices, it's highly likely that you make a lot of money. And whether we have to wait a week or 2 years has never been our forte. We do find, with the exception of the late 90s and the last couple of years, you seldom don't have to wait a couple of years, but that was extreme. This is extreme. The valuations are very, very extreme. So if I had to guess, it will be sooner rather than later. But we're less interested in the timing than we are in the magnitude, and the magnitude of the undervaluation of some of these countries and sectors is something I haven't seen in 34 years. So I can't give the catalyst other than valuation should serve to be its own catalyst.
Excellent. Thank you.
Once again, it's star one if you'd like to ask a question. We'll go next to Gary Magnuson with Morgan Stanley.
Hi, Dave. I was wondering if you could kind of talk about the types of companies you've bought over the years, from Tradewinds to now. It seems like now you have a little bit more in the hard asset space, I guess. Maybe you could, I don't want to put words in your mouth, though. So I was wondering if you could just kind of talk about where you found value over the years and how it went.
Absolutely. We'd love to talk about that. Thank you. We, as I mentioned earlier, from the bottom up, we try to come up with what we think a business should be worth with normal margins over a long period of time. And the market seems to dictate what we're going to own. In the 80s and 90s, owned big U.S. drug companies and soap companies and utilities, all different things. But it was interesting how roughly a dozen years ago, following 20-some-odd years of bear market, the market went from, in the early 80s, loving oil and loving agriculture and loving gold and loving base materials to absolutely hating them. And so the market compelled us to start getting into hard assets. They were giving them away. It wasn't gold so much. It was, let's buy copper at 10 cents a pound. Copper companies. We bought three nickel companies. We were able to buy lead and zinc. We bought fertilizer for next to nothing. Coal, uranium, those sort of things. We owned a lot of it back in those days. Now, by 07, we still liked all those things. We didn't own any of them anymore. The market liked them also. Remember in 03, China took off, and by 07, there had been such huge demand for base metals and huge demand for agriculture and for energy. And so once the market agreed with us on that, we sold a lot of it. And it didn't have much then. In early 09, people started wondering if we had changed our stripes and become growth managers. We hadn't changed our stripes. The market had changed theirs. They had said, if you want to own Whole Foods Markets, you don't have to pay $74. We'll sell it to you for $10. Yeah, if you want to buy eBay, you don't have to pay $65. We'll sell it to you for $15. We'll sell you Microsoft for $15. We'll sell you these great growth companies in India, like ICICI Bank was down 85%, and Tata Motors was down more than 85%. And so then we were buying a lot of growth companies and emerging market companies. Also, in the 08 period is when gold companies became very, very cheap. That was a year where gold went up for the eighth straight year, yet gold mining stocks, many of them fell 90%. We bought a lot of them. By the middle of 2011, we had sold over half of them. Now the market hates gold immensely, and once again, we're able to buy gold for very, very cheap. But you know, for people that followed us or have access to the records of the funds, you'll see uranium was something that we held a lot of and then later on held none of after it ran up and bought it back. Same thing with fertilizer. Many, many years we owned no health care whatsoever. Then 4 or 5 years ago, Eli Lilly became our biggest holding, and we had Pfizer and Aetna and things like that. That became very cheap. Now we're not finding any healthcare stocks that meet our valuation criteria. What we do is we come up with valuations, and the market sometimes will say, in 1989, we loved Japan, and AT&T can be the largest market cap on Earth. And by 3 years ago, it's a big holding. It was a big holding of ours. And emerging markets, of course, the BRICS were something we couldn't own very much of 4 years ago, and now we own more than we ever have because the market hates it. We decide not to either love them or hate them, but avoid them when the market loves them, and when the market hates them, that's the opportunity. And so we have seen over the last 3 years, we've slowly sold things in the U.S. as they've gone up, and sold healthcare as it's gone up, and sold consumer companies as they've gone up. And right now, a few years ago, we had more in Europe and Japan than we'd had in quite some time, and now we have more in emerging markets than we've had in quite some time. And yes, once again, the market is paying a lot for cash flow they can see, and yet they're selling things cheaply if they can't see the cash flow. Good assets, if we're right about them being good assets, will be turned into meaningful cash flow in the future. So hence, we own uranium in the ground, and coal in the ground, and gold in the ground, and we own utilities that are under-earning at the moment that we think will earn well in the future, and we own gas companies that are hated because they're in emerging markets, and we own telecoms that are hated because they're in emerging markets, and so on and so forth. And you add it all up, I think we're fairly diversified. It's just we have not that much in the U.S. where the market has a lot, and we have roughly a third in the emerging markets. Keep in mind the emerging markets are now more than half of the world's GDP, so in a way maybe we're under-owning them, but we own a lot more in the emerging markets than others, and yes, we tend to have more in tangible assets right now and less in bond-like investments with stable, sustainable, but inadequate cash flows, in our opinion.
Can I ask sort of a dumb question as a follow-up? I know it's not a really dumb question, but how do you respond to people like, say, the Stanford Endowment, where they kind of divested of coal? What's your view of kind of the environment issues and things like that when you're looking at more mining companies and things like that and coal companies, et cetera?
Absolutely not a dumb question. We spend lots of time on such things from an economic standpoint. So, you know, it feels good to own the right things, but more than feels good, we look at sustainability, so we can spend a lot of time modeling something, and things that are good will probably have a better future than things that aren't. Hence the whole idea of bigger margins of safety for some things than for others. So we've got a lot of things going here. One is energy good or bad? And the market goes back and forth. Oh, we'll never have enough energy for 7 billion people. That's now 7.3. That's going to go to 8 billion. Energy, sure, let's pay up for all energy stocks. And then you have times where people don't like energy stocks, that there's just too much energy and the world's slowed down and the world's become way more efficient. And who wants energy? And then even within the energy, there are times where people will say, we will really, really pay up for clean energy. And then there's times where they'll pay up for things like coal because China has a lot of it. And or that if the steel industry picks up, they're going to use it. We tend to say, on the whole concept of energy, we think long-term, more people will use more energy, and that will be offset a little bit by efficiencies and optimizations, and that's good. We think over time, the future is really rosy for things like hydroelectric power and nuclear power and things that are very low variable cost and have no sulfur dioxide and no nitrous and no greenhouse gases. And so we are willing to take a moderate sort of margin of safety on that. And then oil and gas are a little more difficult. Gas is hard to store, needs to be transported, but it's pretty clean, so it's okay. And oil is easy to transport, a little less clean is okay. And then there's coal. Coal is dirty, and coal is really problematic, and coal takes a lot to transport. And we would soon rather not own coal. On the other end of the spectrum, millions of years worth of sunshine have been captured in hydrocarbon form, just like with oil. It is abundant, and it is different grades, but some of it is filled with energy. A lot of countries have coal and don't necessarily have much gas or much hydro or much ability to capture sun, or they all have their own pros and cons. So we can say coal is neither a horrible thing that's going away or a wonderful thing that's panacea. Let's just say it is still half of the world's energy production. It is not going away. It will slowly lose market share. If we might want a 25 or 30 margin of safety for uranium-related things or hydro-related things, maybe we want 40 or 50 or 60 on coal. But coal is a very important resource, and it's especially important to countries like China and India, which the two of them put together have a third of the world's population, more than that's one point, is we don't love it, but we do like it, and we will pay a price for it. And a fraction of a ton is way, way too low a price. And then related, which may or may not be interesting to people, on the whole social issue, there's no clear right or wrong, but it is nice to make the world a better place, especially when it can make things more sustainable and create more money for our shareholders. So to say we will never invest in any business that extracts energy from the ground or metals from the ground, or we're not going to invest in any company that makes bombers, or any company that makes a drug that someone doesn't like. We don't do that, but we do call these companies up, and we do send them letters, and we do say, you have things that are potentially worth billions of dollars, and we're more likely to make those billions of dollars if you make the coal cleaner, and you make the mines safer for your workers, or if you clean up the environment afterwards and leave the place in better shape than you found it. There's less likely to be expropriation. And so whether it's the utilities that are burning coal or the mines that are mining it, we tell people we're long-term investors. Don't make the world less safe and less clean so you can beat by a penny, because that may be cutting off your nose to spite your face. And the saying goes, you might save a penny now and find that your mind's been taken from you in the future, or that there's lawsuits, or that communities won't allow you in. And so we do take it seriously. We don't avoid the industries. We go in there, one, trying to make money in those industries, and two, trying to let people know we approve of sustainability and better environments in the future.
Thanks.
We'll take our next question from Bradley Calder with the Investment Fund for Foundations.
Hi, David. I had a question for you about another undervalued market. I was curious if you guys had looked at any companies there. We're curious if you've been looking at publicly traded companies in Iraq. You had mentioned before that you were comparing Apple to the market cap of Russia, and the market cap in Iraq is around $7 billion, but the oil reserves there are in excess of $7 trillion. So putting things in perspective, it may be interesting. Curious to hear your thoughts. Thanks.
Yes, we go at it from the bottom up, so we don't, as a firm, say, let's look or not look at Iraq, but analysts on their own will say, I've found something there, I haven't found something there. I know our telecom analyst has found interesting things there, and our oil analyst has found interesting things there. It's something that's on our radar screen. It's also something that's very difficult to invest in, to you know, do it through swaps markets or to get set up in all these accounts. So it might be difficult to do, and we don't have anything approved there yet, but it's on our radar screen.
Thank you.
It appears there are no further questions at this time. I'd like to turn the conference back to Mr. Ivan and Mr. Gafar for any final or closing remarks.
All right. Well, once again, thank you all for calling in. It are interesting times, and we think it bodes well for this sort of portfolio. Time will tell. But I appreciate all the good questions and the interest and the support. Thank you very much.
This concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation.